So I thought I would start pretty much where Joe left off last week, which is with the statement of the conjecture. So this, of course, is due to Maldacena. And the conjecture says that four-dimensional supersymmetric, and this is n equals 4, maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory with gauge group SUN is completely equivalent to 2B string theory with the boundary conditions that the metric asymptotically goes to the product of ADS5 cross S5. This is already running out. So the radius of these spheres, well, the S5 and ADS5 are equal, and they're given by, I'm going to use L to denote the radius of the sphere. I was going to use capital R, but I thought it would be confused with the scalar curvature by relativists in the audience. So L is the radius of the ADS space and the 5 sphere, and it's related or given by this formula where G is the string coupling and L sub S is the string length scale. Okay. Now, this is a very difficult conjecture to test because the regime in which we understand string theory is the regime in which the curvatures are all small compared to the string scale, or the sort of radii of curvatures are large compared to the string length, and that's the regime in which Gn is much bigger than 1. On the other hand, the regime in which we know most about Yang-Mills theories is one in which this product, Gn, which also happens to be the effective coupling of the gauge theory, is much less than 1. And most quantities will depend on this coupling of G times N. And so if you compute it at weak coupling in the Yang-Mills theory, and then compute it at strong coupling via this conjecture, they won't agree, and they're not supposed to agree, and so you learn nothing. So the way to sort of check the conjecture is to find quantities which don't depend on the coupling and see if they agree in both cases. And so that's what I'd like to do today, to describe some of the evidence that has accumulated in favor of this conjecture by looking at certain things which one can argue or hope doesn't depend too strongly on the coupling. So let me start with a few preliminaries. And this is just to remind you of a couple facts about ADS and about these Yang-Mills theories. So first of all, ADS, as I'm sure you all know, ADS5 can be viewed as a certain surface in a six-dimensional flat space. So you have a 6D flat space with signature 4, 2. And you look at the surface, which is minus t1 squared, minus t2 squared, plus x1 squared, the x4 squared, is equal to minus some constant squared, which is just the ADS radius L squared. If you let t over L be the rotation angle in this t1, t2 time-y plane, and you let r squared equal just the usual radius in terms of the four Euclidean directions here, then the metric induced on this surface takes the familiar form. It's just minus r squared over l squared plus 1 dt squared plus the r squared. Omega 3. This metric is globally static. It, as obtained here, has closed time-like curves because t is a rotation angle. It comes to you periodically identified. But of course, once you have the metric, you can unwrap it, go to the covering space, let t go from minus infinity to plus infinity, and you now have a nice space without closed time-like curves. You notice that if you multiply this metric by a conformal factor, multiply by L squared over R squared, and then take the limit for large R, take the limit as R goes to infinity, what you get is, well, you get a boundary, which is just minus dt squared from here. We're looking at, say, a surface at large R, so we'll drop that. You multiply this by L squared over R squared, and this is L squared d omega 3. In other words, you can conformally rescale this metric so that it fits inside a cylinder where the radius of the sphere is the same as the ADS radius. So this is now, this is the boundary sort of at infinity, which has, you know, sort of an S3 cross R, with this having the same radius as the ADS. Now, you might say, why do I prefer this conformal factor? We know from the usual discussion of infinities that you can conformally rescale with any conformal factor, and that's certainly, well, any conformal factor which makes the metric smooth on the boundary. That's certainly true, and that's, in fact, why the theory we get on the boundary has to be a conformal field theory rather than a theory without this extra conformal symmetry, because of this fact that we really have just a conformal metric on the boundary. However, this metric that you get by conformally rescaling by L squared over R squared is in some sense preferred because this is the one for which the natural time translation on the cylinder at infinity is the same as the symmetry, which is the global time translation in ADS. So the claim is if you think of the boundary as having radius, the free sphere having radius L, the natural time translation is the same symmetry as the one that you had in the interior. Yeah.
This is probably obvious to the relativists, but I don't understand why the angle in the time-like plane is the natural time-like coordinates.
It's a globally defined time-like symmetry. It's not unique. Okay? So if you ask me, are there other globally defined, everywhere time-like Killing vectors, the answer is yes. And you can see that by just, say, doing a boost, you know, starting with this parameterization, boosting, say, in the T2 X1 plane, tilting this time-like plane a little bit, taking your new coordinate to be the rotation angle in that tilted time-like plane, you can do the same thing and you get another description of the surface. So, of course, this metric has a large symmetry group. It's the SO4,2 symmetries. And this is one sort of globally defined time-like symmetry. There are others.
And if I chose one of the other ones?
They're all conjugate, aren't they?
They're all conjugate.
It's like choosing different time translations in Minkowski space. Not exactly the same.
Yeah, no, it's very similar just choosing different time translations in Minkowski space.
What if I wanted T1 to be my time direction?
Well, T1 by itself is not such a good choice because it won't be globally time-like. But let me give you another one which is often discussed and it plays a role in the story.
But here, I mean, this is not really a preferred compound factor because I can just multiply it by any function of angles. And d by dt would still be the obvious scaling factor.
Right, so you could multiply this by any function of the angles, and then you get some sort of deformed sphere, I guess, on the boundary. Yeah. So the criterion that it matches the symmetries doesn't uniquely fix this. I agree. But it's the simplest one, and it's sort of one to keep in mind if you don't like to work with equivalence classes of conformal metrics and things like that. It makes things a little bit more concrete, and I find it useful. Okay. So I said there was another one that is often discussed, and so let me mention that next. And that's what happens if you pick out a null vector in this six-dimensional flat space, and let's let, so alternatively, one could say pick out a null direction. And let's introduce a coordinate rho, which is, say, t1 minus x1. And then you can introduce other coordinates, say, another time coordinate, which is just t2 times this ADS radius L over rho. And then xi's, which are the capital coordinates times little L over rho. And if you choose those coordinates and work out the metric on the hypersurface, you find that this is rho squared over L squared times minus d tilde squared times I squared. Okay, so these are sometimes called Poincaré coordinates because you see a manifest Poincaré group acting on these little x's and little z's. It's the same metric, of course, written in different coordinate systems. But this is, in a sense, where the whole story started, because if you start with the full asymptotically flat three-brain solution, and this is going back to Don's lectures from several weeks ago, you write down the supergravity solution, which has a charge associated with the self-dual phi form, you get a black three-brain. The extremal limit of that metric, if you go, it has a horizon, you come near the horizon, and you see this metric. And in fact, rho equals zero is the actual event horizon of the three brain. This is the event horizon of the extremal three brain. And if you ask sort of what does that correspond to in terms of this picture, of course, here's a picture of ADS which doesn't look like it has any horizons, and it doesn't in that sense, but this particular coordinate system has a null surface where your symmetry d by dt is becoming null, and in terms of this diagram, it's just, the picture is this. So here's rho equals zero, this is rho positive, and up here we have regions where rho becomes negative in those coordinates. So this coordinate system basically just covers this patch of ADS, and this is the event horizon of the extremal free brain. Okay, one more little fact about before we get into the evidence. So, Super Yang-Mills, let me just remind you what this theory has. There is, of course, gauge fields, AU. There are spinners, psi alpha, and scalars. And there are six scalars, four Lyell fermions. And one gauge field. But all of these fields take values in the adjoint of the group. So it's essentially all Hermitian matrices, yeah.
I'm sorry, just to be clear, when you do the conformal diagram there with the zigzags, are both the left and the right-hand side the boundary at infinity?
Yeah. So the way this works is, this is like that. It's exactly the same. Okay, so this is a cylinder. And what I'm really drawing here is a null plane cutting through the cylinder. And so there's a null plane coming in here, a null plane coming out there, and it's the wedge of the cylinder which is between these two null planes.
So if you're looking at the field theory on the sphere or anything which is not flat, but is conformal, how do you integrate the supercurrent into a supercharge if there are a coherent and constant sphere?
I'm gonna have to think about that a little bit. There's probably, there's some analog. I guess you could take. Let me think about that. We can talk about it later. Okay, so that's enough of the preliminaries. Let me actually come to what you're all here to hear about. What's the evidence for this conjecture? Why does anyone take it seriously? So, let me start.
The group is S-U-N?
Yeah, the group is S-U-N.
S-U-N.
S-U-N. Now, Joe, in his lectures, described what happens when you bring N D-brains close together, and said that what you find is that you find on the D-brains a U-N gauge theory, but the overall U-1 factor describes center of mass motion of the D-brains. It's moving all N D-brains uniformly, fluctuating them all together. And so if you want to sort of imagine the D-brains as sort of being fixed at some place and just looking at internal excitations, the appropriate group is the S-U-N group. And that's the one which is believed to be appropriate here. Okay, first of all, something which Joe already mentioned, the symmetries agree. Okay, so you can just check ADS5 cross S5 has isometries which are just given by the group. This is SO4, 2 cross SO6. And the 4D gauge theory is a conformally invariant theory. The conformal group in four dimensions is SO4, 2. Conformal symmetry is SO4, 2. And then we have these six scalars. And so there's another symmetry of the theory which just rotates these six scalars among each other, and that gives you the SO6. In addition, these theories both have supersymmetries, and if you check, the supersymmetries agree as well. Although I won't, the supersymmetries agree. I won't go through that in detail.
So this is agreement at the level of supergravity, not at the level of string theory. Is that right? Or is there a way? How do we think of that SO42 cross SO6 as a symmetry of the whole string theory?
Well, it's a particular, first of all, it's a particular classical solution of string theory. And perturbation theory about this particular solution will have this symmetry. So it's not just supergravity sort of perturbation theory, it's full string theory perturbation theory about this solution will have this symmetry.
Okay. So then it's a symmetry of the solution, not of the theory of the whatever.
Well, it's not
field equations. Or.
It's not a symmetry of the full string theory because it's clearly tied to these boundary conditions and this particular choice of classical background that we're going to.
I want to understand how much it's tied just to the boundary conditions and how much it's tied to a particular classical solution. Is there any sense that you can say that any classical solution of string theory with those boundary conditions has this symmetry as a whole?
No, it has the symmetry asymptotically.
Okay.
That's what you can say, is that any solution of string theory which asymptotically goes to ADS5 cross S5 will have this symmetry asymptotically. Because the ADS5 cross S5 solution has it, and therefore you're supposed to think of this as the asymptotic symmetry group of the space-time being identified with or being equivalent to the symmetry of the gauge theory.
Okay.
Mark?
Technical question. I thought you didn't know how to do string perturbation theory in background or model.
That, I think, is sort of a technical question.
Yeah.
I think, in principle, nobody doubts that it's well-defined. It's just hard to calculate, and it's, you know, it's hard to do. But, I don't think this is a serious problem.
I have more of a conceptual question.
Yeah.
As I recall from Joe's lecture last week, we have the SUN gauge theory corresponds to N D brains on top of each other, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was, you know, one argues that when you have N brains on top of each other, you have an SUN gauge symmetry. And then you go near the pile of brains, and then you find that the metric takes on a certain form, and by taking a certain limit, you get this ABS5 cross S5. So at this level, we're supposed to completely forgotten about the brains. Is that right?
Yeah.
We don't have to know whether...
You can actually forget everything that Joe said.
Right.
Because in some sense, it was motivation.
Right.
Okay, and the view I want to take is, suppose you don't know any string theory,
mm-hmm.
and you're just presented with this conjecture,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, you can just take it at face value and say, okay, why do I believe it? You know,
right.
What is it? So that's right. D-brains don't enter the story.
They don't enter anymore.
Anymore. Okay. It was all sort of motivation.
Okay, but then... even string theory is gone then, right? You just have this metric at this point on one side of the conjecture?
Well,
or this...
supergravity is, of course, the low energy limit of string theory.
Right.
So to the extent that you're willing to sort of ask questions dealing with the low energy limit,
mm-hmm.
then all you have to worry about is supergravity.
Okay.
And so in fact, this was supposed to be a little bit more, but for, you know, some of the things I'm going to say next really deal with just the supergravity limit.
Okay.
But the conjecture is stronger. The conjecture says that even if you don't stay with the supergravity fields, if you start going to higher energies, then you start getting string excitations in ADS, and the gauge theory is still supposed to include those.
Oh, okay. So it's the full string theory living in ADS 5 cross S 5.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Steve? I would only protest, maybe on Joe's behalf, that D-brains were essential to motivating the guess that there was SUN local gauge symmetry.
Of course.
What a fucking accident.
Nobody would have theory. I mean, even Juan would not have, you know, dared make such a crazy conjecture if it hadn't been for all of the early work, you know, that, you know, Joe started with his D-brains, you know, Steve, you and Igor and everybody did to sort of get, you know, familiar with the idea of the connection between the D-brains and the black holes and the near horizon limits and all of that. I'm just saying, after the fact, you can really turn it all around and forget where it came from and just say, okay, if this is true, you know, we should see it. We should be able to sort of study it in its own right without all of that, you know, motivation.
It was for the benefit of that relativists.
No, I wasn't trying to belittle any contributions of those. Yeah, this clearly would not have happened without all of that important work.
Well, the Witten paper on bound states and D-brains.
Yeah, a lot, yeah.
So in this in the 40 year superangular case, I mean, SO42 also acts in the scalars, right?
Well, they act as scalars.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the symmetry on the space-time symmetry, and they transform as scalars.
And SO6 is like the internals. SO6 acts not trivially only on the scalars.
Exactly.
Where the internals.
Yeah, it rotates. You say it also acts on the fermions, right? Because they're in a
representation of SO6.
Yes, these are in a spinner representation of SO6.
Oh, so it also acts on fermions, but doesn't do anything to the gauge theory?
No.
So let me just point out already one sort of, to me, non-trivial consequence of this fact, that the symmetries agree. So remember I said back over here that if you looked at the actual extremal free-grain metric, went near the horizon, you saw this geometry with rho equals zero being the event horizon. If you go to weak coupling, in fact, rho becomes just the ordinary radial coordinate in a flat space and can only take positive values. Rho equals zero is like an origin, and rho greater than zero is the rest of space. When you go to strong coupling, that rho equals zero becomes the horizon, and you have this whole region behind the event horizon. So because in some sense, everything was motivated by studying the D-brains in flat space, where rho clearly never became negative, and you got the gauge theory. It's natural to ask whether the gauge theory describes only the space-time or string theory in this patch, or whether it could possibly describe the physics behind the horizon. And there is a very simple argument that it must, in fact, be able to describe physics behind the horizon. So the gauge theory, Super Yang-Mills, describes sort of, let's say, the string theory or the physics behind the horizon. This is rho net less than zero, as well as the region which you expect, rho greater than zero. And the argument for this is simply that this particular subset of ADS is not invariant under this full symmetry group. We had to pick a null vector in order to introduce those coordinates, in order to write the metric in this form. And if you ask what isometries preserve this region, you find a subset of this group. You find basically the four-dimensional Poincaré group plus an extra dilation, but you don't get these special conformal transformations. So the region rho greater than zero is not invariant under the full SO4,2, but the gauge theory is. And so the gauge theory is clearly describing string theory in the whole space, and is in no way restricted to the region on one side of this null surface. Okay, let me now move on to the next sort of piece of evidence, which is that now we're going to look at, let me say it first. So the claim is that all low energy states in string theory on ADS5, process 5, have corresponding states in the Super Yang-Mills. And I'll explain what I mean by corresponding states in the Super Yang-Mills theory. Okay, so first of all, the vacuum of the gauge theory is supposed to correspond to this particular background, ADS5 cross S5, with no excitations. And now we're basically doing perturbation theory about this background, and we want to know what the low energy excitations are. Well, I've already mentioned that the low energy limit of string theory is just supergravity, so we want to look at the supergravity, and this is now type 2b supergravity on this background. So basically we're going to look at linearized, to find out what the sort of excitations are, linearized 2b supergravity on ADS5, process 5. And what does that look like? Well, as you heard last week or the week before or sometime in these pedagogical lectures, 2B supergravity in 10 dimensions starts off with a certain finite number of fields. There's the metric. There's a three-form H mu mu rho. There's the dilaton. And then there are these Ramon-Ramon fields. And I'll just write them. There's a one-form field, a three-form, and a five-form. Now we want to compactify on S5. So you compactify, and each of these fields becomes actually several fields, in fact, several infinite families of fields, because you know, for example, that the metric can, first of all, if all the indices are tangent to the ADS and not tangent to the S5, gives you a metric g mu nu 5 in the five-dimensional space. Also, if one vector is tangent to the S5 and the other one is not, you get a vector which is, I don't know, some Kluge Klein vector field, A5, and if both vectors are, both indices are tangent to the 5, this gives you scalars, etc. So each of these fields, you know, ends up splitting up into several fields in the five-dimensional case. But more than that, each of these gives you infinite families of fields because we have to include the higher harmonics on the S5. The fact that the ADS radius is the same as the radius on the 5-sphere means that it's not consistent just to look at the lowest modes where all of these fields are more or less homogeneous on the 5-sphere. It's essential to keep all of the higher excitations as well. So each of these fields sort of multiplies and gives you, in the end, that you get many infinite families of fields, five-dimensional fields, on ADS5. That's from the supergravity side. And now the claim is, this is the statement, that for each of these fields, each of these many infinite families of fields, sort of there is a corresponding field. Well, I'll say what I mean by corresponding now. There exists a field in super Yang-Mills satisfying three properties such that, okay, first of all, it's in the same representation.
Gary, can I ask, is this a typo before you go on?
Yeah.
Is that G mu nu contains psi? Is that a fermionic field? No.
No, I'm sorry.
No, that's not a psi.
This is a scalar, but I didn't want to use phi.
Okay, it's a scalar field.
It's a scalar field.
Fine.
Okay, so first of all, these are all in the same representations of our symmetry group.
It's the lapse and the shift, right? A mu phi and psi, more or less. You said G mu nu phi was tangent.
Yeah.
Well, there are linear transformations of them.
Not exactly, because ADS5 is a whole space time in its own right. It'll have its own lapse and shift when you time slice it. Mm-hmm. This is a little different. Okay. Second, these fields will generally have mass when you talk about the Kaluza-Klein reduction. The higher modes will have a mass as far as the ADS5 is concerned. And for each mass, there is a corresponding dimension of these operators on the super Yang-Mills side. And so the claim is that these fields have mass such that the dimension is given by this formula, delta is equal to 2 plus the square root of 4 plus m squared, where m is the sort of supergravity mass of the field. This is determined by looking at solutions of these massive field equations, seeing how they fall off near infinity, and when you conformally rescale, there's a whole story there which I can go into if you want, but let me just assert that this is the sort of correspondence one needs, and so that's what we're going to look for. The dimension is given by this, and this is in particle physics units of dimension. In other words, this is dimensions of mass, not dimensions of length. Okay, anyone is worried about that. Oh, and finally, and perhaps most importantly, these fields are all going to be in essentially short multiplets of the supersymmetry algebra.
Do I interpret that statement literally, that all dimensions of all the massless fields then have dimension 4?
The supergravity counterparts of all massless all fields which are massless in ADS5, uh-huh. Yes, all fields which are massless in ADS5 are described by dimension 4 operators in the
in the superangles. Right.
Okay.
Gary.
Yeah.
Not to be too artistic over, do you have a notion of mass in mind for higher spins, not just scalars? So this formula is true without corrections, because sometimes we might have formulas for higher spins.
Okay, you say this is only valid for the scalars?
Well, these are definitely valid for the scalars, and then for higher spin objects in ABS, there's different ways that people try to define the mass.
None of which will get that wrong.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for the clarification, and this is, I was taking this.
So the scalar operators is disqualified.
First, at least the scalars, and there's several infinite families of scalars, so it's already a non-trivial fact.
There exist generalizations in the literature.
Right.
There is any formula for the higher spin scalars.
Yeah, so there's presumably some analogous formula for the higher spin things, which I don't know. Maybe it's not known yet.
But it's always, there's always some kind of Casimir or the SO42.
Yeah, I mean, the correspondence has been spelled out for all fields.
Yes.
So it is known what the right field is, but I guess it depends on how you define the mass and how you write those.
There's a formula for each division of the mass.
There's a formula for each. Okay, yeah. The non-trivial statement is that nobody doubts what the corresponding operator is. It's just how you define the mass will change the formula. Okay, technicalities. These are all in short multiplets of the supersymmetry algebra, which tells you that this dimension is not corrected. It's not changed when you go from weak coupling to strong coupling. So,
may I ask you something?
Yeah.
I think you comment on this, but maybe you can say something more. Usually when one makes a Kalousek-Klein reduction and expands this, in this case, harmonics on the H5, one only takes the lowest states, maybe the massless states. But then you made a comment, in this case, one has to take also the other ones, and you said something, this is related to the radius. Could you comment on this?
Sure. Normally, when people do Kaluza-Klein theory, they imagine the compact space as being very small.
Right.
If the compact space is very small, the higher harmonics are very massive as fields in the lower dimensional space, and so it makes sense to ignore them, leave them out if you're only asking low-energy questions about the compactified theory. But we're now in a situation where the radius of the S5 is not small. This is in both sense a really five-dimensional space-time. It's really a 10-dimensional space-time, because the curvature here is exactly the same as
that. Low energy limit. So how does this come?
Well, this is low energy with respect to the scale of energy you need to excite a string. Okay, that's much higher. Okay, so this is low energy states in string theory. If you want, you can replace that by essentially all states of the supergravity theory. Right, it's not low energy in the supergravity theory. Okay, well, let me just give you some examples.
Gary?
Yeah?
I think it might be worth emphasizing that these things in the superangles are all gauge invariant operators.
Yes, that is also true. Okay, they're certainly gauge invariant.
You haven't exhibited evidence for these claims, is that correct?
Well, no, I have not given you evidence for these claims. The symmetries I took as self-evident. This is the claim, this is a restatement of the claim, and now I'm just going to quote some examples.
With evidence?
Let's see. The evidence is that people have given the actual correspondence. Usually the simplest way of doing this is taking advantage of the group theory. Okay, so another way of saying what this conjecture is, you already know the symmetry groups are the same. The states are going to fall into representations of the symmetry algebra. So the statement here is really that you have the same sort of multiplicities of the representations in the supergravity side and in the Yang-Mills side. So that's all you have to show, is that each representation appears sort of at the same multiplicity on both sides. And that's usually easier to do if you work with some sort of super fields and super, big algebra stuff. But I thought that
if you want to be critical, you could argue that it follows by the symmetries. This all these results here actually follow from what you wrote before. If you just know the supersymmetries on either side, you can derive the spectrum.
No, I don't think so. I think the supersymmetries don't tell you that the representations will have exactly the same representations and the same multiplicities and all that. It's not enough.
You get one.
For example, you get 22 or something.
Yeah. No, I think it's not enough just to know that the symmetries agree. This is another non-trivial statement about the correspondence that the multiplicities match up. Yeah?
You could get that maybe from just the fact that the symmetry angles is decoupling of the thing.
Well, if you go back to the whole story that, you know, we heard with Joe and Don and all that other stuff, yes, this is sort of motivation. This is strong motivation that this correspondence is right. And depending on how, you know, much faith you have in that motivation, you can call it a derivation and say you're done. Okay? And then, yes, you expect it to work. But again, I'm taking the view that maybe you didn't believe, you know, all that stuff, or you want to see some independent facts, some checks. Okay, so here's a check.
How about, I mean, as you said, I mean, when one gets infinitely many fields there,
yeah.
But you also told us that in supersymmetric Yang-Yields theory, you listed all the fields for us.
Ah, no, no, here it comes. What I listed for you were the sort of fundamental fields which appear in the Lagrangian. What corresponds to these supergravity fields are composite fields. Okay, so I'm going to start telling you what they are and give you some infinite families. Okay, so the simplest thing is to take the example. So on the supergravity side, let's look at, say, the dilaton. And for simplicity, let's look at just the lowest mode, which is actually constant on S5. It's constant on S5. This is something which really satisfies just the massless wave equation. So it's a massless scalar. So here's one. So massless scalar. So we need a field in the Super Yang-Mills, which is, well, this is, of course, a scalar under the S5. It's constant on the S5. It's a scalar under the SO42. It has to have dimension 4, as Tony said. It's got to be in a short multiplet, gauge invariant. The answer is that it's just trace F squared. That's the operator on the Super Yang-Mills side corresponding to the dilaton, which is constant on S5. Now let's look at, you can ask about the higher modes of the dilaton. And I hope the experts give me a little bit of leeway here. I'm going to be a little bit imprecise, but I'll give you the idea. Okay, so the higher modes, modes of the dilaton are described now by an operator. Well, of course, there's many fields here, so there are many operators. And let me call them O(n). They're trace of some coefficients, ci1 to cin, of f squared, this operator, times x, sorry, these phis, the fundamental scalar fields, which appeared in the n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, phi i1 to in. So for every integer n, almost every integer n, you get a some operator here, where you take f squared, take the product of n of these scalars, and now these coefficients have to be essentially symmetric and traceless.
What if I took the same operators without the f squared?
Ah, you can do the same thing without the f squared. That gives you another infinite family of operators, which actually correspond to, that'll be number 3. Okay, okay, let's do that.
What are conformal dimensions in this number 2?
What they're supposed to be. So, what are the dimensions? Well, first of all, you have this formula. And you might say, this is really weird, because there's a square root in there. And how am I going to get something which has a fractional or irrational dimension if I just take products of these things? And I've told you, you can compute the dimension naively, and you don't have to worry about strong coupling effects, because these are all supposed to be protected. Well, the answer is that this turns out to be an integer. It's one of these miracles of, actually, this was a miracle that was discovered in the mid-80s when people did supergravity compactified on a phi-sphere. You look at the masses you get by this Kaluza-Klein reduction, and the masses are all such that if you add 4, you get the square of an integer. And so these dimensions are all integers. And that's, in one sense, another reason why this works. It's a non-trivial fact.
What more evidence do you want?
Yeah, what more evidence do you want? Stop now. okay, so it should be clear that this, taking these phis, which you can think of as sort of like vectors in the six-dimensional space, symmetric traceless combinations of products of the phis are just the spherical harmonics on the phi-sphere. So these clearly are going to have all the right SO6 representations to describe the higher modes of the dilaton, and I claim the dimension works out with the right mass and everything. And to answer Mark's question, he said, well, what if you just leave out the F? And of course, you can do that too. And so you get operators which now look like this, another infinite family of operators without the F, phi j, I1 to IN, I said. Again, this is symmetric and traceless as before. And what this corresponds to are essentially the internal components of the metric. So you take the metric with the all the indices projected into the sphere, sort of g mu nu, sort of with indices in S5. This would then be a scalar as far as the SO, as far as the ADS5 goes, and these are all scalars as far as the space-time goes. You have the the right SO6 representations again coming from those spherical harmonic-like expansions. So again, this works. The only sort of subtlety here is that when you linearize the fields, you have to really decouple them. And so if you sort of do a straightforward linearization of the supergravity equations in 10 dimensions, compactified on a sphere, there is some interactions. So the sort of linearly independent combinations, I think, actually has a bit of the sort of beam you knew on the phi sphere added into the metric on the phi sphere to get some sort of independent combination. But anyway, that linearly independent combination is what you get, right? Is what corresponds to these things. Yeah.
Shouldn't there be also protected operators with fermions in them, or do those all come from acting in supercharged form?
Well, yeah. I mean, the supergravity has fermions in them as well. I've not written the fermions, but they would be here. Right, they're certainly the gravitino and things, and they have modes, and they are described by operators on this side which have fermions in them. Okay, I've just sort of left off that story.
Right, but I mean, like, there must be like gauge invariant things with two fermions on the A-series that have been protected, which have to add the mode, or are none of those primary?
So the H mu nu, they could come from the three forces.
Okay. I have a conceptual question. On the supergravity side, each one of the fields corresponds to a particle by construction, right?
Well, each one of the fields corresponds to a whole sort of box space of particles. But
right.
Yes, you can
right.
create one particle.
Right. Now, in the super Yang-Mills field, on the super Yang-Mills side, is it obvious that each one of these operators actually would correspond to particle in the sense if I calculate the Green's function, that I would find a pole and all this?
Yeah, you can.
I mean, that's a non-trivial statement about super Yang-Mills now, right?
Well, okay. Remember the best way to understand this is to first of all go on the ADS side. Okay, so we said that the ADS is thought of as the interior of the cylinder, and if you take any of these fields. I mean, in particular, just the simplest massless scalar field on ADS5, and you just quantize it. Okay, so you look at the modes, you find a discrete spectrum. In other words, the negative cosmological constant effectively gives you an infinite potential barrier near infinity, and so the energy eigenstates of a scalar field in ADS are discrete.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for the fields on the supergravity side, ADS sort of have a discrete spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can expand the fields in modes, and you can introduce creation and annihilation operators, and you can create states, but these states have definite energies with respect to this time-like killing field that I picked out. Well, the same is true for the Yang-Mills theory on the sphere. Mm. So on the sphere, super Yang mills on S3, you can take these operators and again essentially expand them in modes.
And where did the S3 come from? In the statement of the conjecture, there was no S3. The conjecture implies S3.
Well, when I said it's the four-dimensional gauge theory.
Right. When you say four-dimensional, you mean S3.
Well,
it has to be space S3.
It's conformally invariant. You can think of it on R4, but it's better for these sort of issues to think of it as conformally compactified onto S3 cross R.
Mm-hmm. You can do that only if the net charge is zero. So when you're always looking at net charge is zero, otherwise you have the singularity.
You mean Yang-Mills charge?
Yeah.
What is this? I mean, this is a U1 subgroup you're thinking of as having a charge? Or?
Yang-Mills has charge, right? Supposing you have an asymptotic black case, so you didn't compact it back then.
Yeah.
You fix some internal frame at infinity, and you get a charge which has an internal index. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can construct scalars from it if you like, but if any of these charges is not equal to zero, I mean, it's the same reason why there is a singularity at I0 for in general relativity.
I don't think that's come up. So I guess people are always looking at configurations of the Yang-Mills theory with zero value of those charges.
We're certainly always looking at gauge invariant operators, which would be.
Right, so these charges are gauge dependent then.
No, I mean, I can take square of the charge.
Take the square of the charge.
Yeah.
It's gauge invariant.
What about twisted bundles? Like instantonic sectors of the Yang-Mills.
There's no instant times on S3 cross R, you're saying. You need an S4.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one way to do it.
But maybe.
We can come back to this. I mean, there should be a list of good questions.
Actually, of course. Global charges are corresponding to superconduction sectors. So if you're just acting with local operators, you can't move between zero charge sectors and non-zero charge sectors. You start with the vacuum and you work with these and draw all the zero charge sectors.
Okay.
But on the Yang-Mills side, are these fields supposed to be local?
Yeah, these are local fields. Yeah, these are all local fields. So just to finish up the answer to Tony's question, so the claim is that on the super Yang-Mills side, you can again take these fields, expand them in modes, and introduce creation annihilation operators, and basically, again, produce states, which, the fact that the dimensions are what they are is what guarantees that the energy of the modes you create here will be the same as the energy on the supergravity side. Okay, well let me go on, because I have two more pieces of evidence I want to give you, and I've only gotten through two in 50 minutes, so I'm going to be really quick on the next one, because I want to have time for the last one. Okay, so what's the next one? Three is interactions. So far, I've said the symmetries agree, I've said all of the sort of perturbative states agree, all the sort of supergravity states agree, and I think that's sort of already, I hope I've convinced you, a non-trivial statement, but some interactions agree. I should have said, I'm not giving references to any of this. This is certainly not my work. This is a review with lots of people who have worked on this stuff. So various things have been checked. Let me just quote one result. One result is that if you think of three-point functions. So look at the three-point coupling of those particular super Yang-Mills operators on the one hand, or the supergravity fields on the other. So these three-point functions can be computed sort of either of two ways, sort of super Yang-Mills at small coupling, or the supergravity, which corresponds to large coupling, as I said, which is large Yang-Mills coupling. And what was shown was that, well, first of all, for any of these operators in the large n limit, so this is one more sort of thing, in large n limit. Okay, so that means that we're holding fixed gn. Gn is the effect of coupling. So this is the sort of the angles coupling. But you can take the limit as n gets very big, g goes to 0 with that fixed. In the large n limit, people have calculated the three-point function of those operators and done a supergravity calculation of the corresponding supergravity fields with the interactions you have in supergravity, and you find complete agreement.
How did you find things in supergravity, three-point functions in supergravity?
You do the brute force thing. You take the supergravity Lagrangian, you expand it. So to leading order, you get the quadratic terms, which are just the linearized sort of supergravity modes. You then keep the next order terms, which are the cubic interactions. And it's a bit of a mess. And you work out what the three-point function you get from those sort of cubic terms in the supergravity Lagrangian. I mean, it's quite remarkable because, again, you know, the dynamics on supergravity side looks on the face of it completely separate from the dynamics on the angle side. Theories look very different. And yet, these particular states seem to match up, and their interactions match up at the level of these three-point functions.
But aren't decorrelation functions, are there three-point functions given by supercomplement invariance
alone?
Well, the Cybergen and Waller did more. They showed that the coefficients came
up. Coefficients.
And that's a complete surprise, because now you're saying there's actually a recoupling result that agrees with the strong coupling result, which is not part of the conjecture. That's a surprise.
Well, no, they also argued that in many cases there are non-generalization theorems protecting both the T1 functions and the three functions.
Since they agree, they must have done something.
No. There are pre-existing non-generalization theorems, which they then checked. And the recoupling plus non-generalization theorem plus the agreement, that's the evidence for the conjecture.
I think the correct statement is that the form of the three-point function is determined by the symmetry of the three-point function up to a couple of coefficients. These coefficients,
three-point
functions, one coefficient. The coefficient agrees. In some cases, that agreement is necessary for the conjecture to be true because there's a non-normalization theorem. But not in all cases where agreement is found is there a known non-normalization
theorem. Can I just ask a very naive question, because this comes up again and again about non-normalization theorems of supergravity. I mean, we know the theory doesn't make sense, so what is the theory?
It's always
being used on the
Yang-Mills side. Mm-hmm. Can I go back one step? Is that allowed?
Sure.
Short step. Okay, very short. I'm not sure if I'm happy with the answer. Your answer to my question now, because you said something about if you expand super Yang-Mills on S3 and expand in modes and so on, then the masses will agree. But then you also said that we don't have to do it on S3, we can do it on any other S3 manifold. Do the masses always agree? I mean, that would be a remarkable statement, that no matter what manifold you're expanding on.
When you do it, for example, on R4, the natural time translation symmetry on Minkowski space is different from this global time translation on ADS. And in fact, it corresponds to this time translation in these Poincaré coordinates that I introduced at the beginning, which only go in a way.
Right.
Okay, so the idea would be that if the states of the states of the Yang-Mills theory on Minkowski space should be connected to the states on this wedge in ADS, but that's much harder to quantify because you have infrared problems, states very large.
But people believe that it's just difficult to work out. But people believe that would still hold.
Yeah, I mean this is just a one. Okay, I'm almost out of time, but Tony last week asked if he could see a real calculation with twos and pi's and everything of the entropy. So I thought I would do that as my fourth piece of evidence. So the motivation here is that what have we said so far? We have the symmetries of the two theories agreeing. The perturbative states, well, the perturbative theories seem to be agreeing in the sense that the sort of linearized sort of free fields agree, and some of these interactions agree. Now, of course, not all interactions will agree, because at some point you expect there to be differences between the weak coupling and strong coupling theory, but at least for these particular three-point functions of those special operators, we have reasons to believe that they should agree, and they do. Okay, but now you might say, how do we know this has anything to do with interesting physical phenomena other than perturbation theory about ADS? So we want to go and talk about black holes in, say, an ADS spacetime. So we now want to get away from perturbation theory and ask, can the gauge theory possibly describe real big black, well, not real, but big black holes in asymptotically ADS spacetime? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to claim that the answer is yes. And so the entropy, okay, so the Yang-Mills theory, well, let me just say it this way, the Yang-Mills theory has enough states to describe sort of large black holes in ADS.
What's the meaning of large?
Large means, in this case, big. So the Schwarzschild radius is big compared to the radius of curvature of the ADS. Okay, of course, this is the interesting case. Very small black holes are going to be Schwarzschild. They're just going to look like Schwarzschild. They're going to have much lower energy. So we're now looking at sort of a high energy, high energy states where you have big black holes and you want to see if the entropies can agree. Okay, so I'm going to show you, just to get to the punchline, that the entropy you calculate in the Yang-Mills theory can be compared with the entropy you calculate in supergravity, and it has the same dependence on n, on the string coupling, on the parameters of the solution. The numerical coefficient is off by 3/4. Okay, just so you don't get disappointed later, I won't make a mistake on the board unless I don't get 3/4. The answer is that the entropies disagree by a factor of 3/4, which is very famous. It was, I guess, calculated by Andy Strominger and by Gupser, Klebanoff, and Pete a couple years ago. Nobody has a good explanation for that 3/4 other than the fact that look roughly similar. Okay, so what's the solution? We're going to start with Schwarzschild ADS. Okay, so the metric is minus F dt squared plus dr squared over F plus r squared d omega 3, where, okay, so F, the function only of r, it's given by 1 minus r0 squared over r squared. We're in 5 dimensions, so the mass goes like 1 over r squared. And of course, we have the cosmological constant, so you have the r squared over l squared. Now, we want to compute the temperature of this metric. And one way to do that is simply to analytically continue to go to the Euclidean. Oh, sorry. I was going to. All right, I'll do that later. Okay. So one way to compute the temperature is to analytically continue. It requires, as usual, that there's not a conical singularity at the horizon. So the horizon here is where R is at the zero. That is some value R plus where F is zero. The temperature, the Hawking temperature that you get for any metric of this form to remove the conical singularity turns out to be simply the derivative of this function f evaluated at the horizon divided by 4 pi. And so that works for Schwarzschild, it works for any of these black holes. And so if you just plug in this value of f, you find that the temperature is 1 over 4 pi, 2 r0 squared over r plus cubed plus 2 r plus over l squared. Okay, that's just taking the derivative of f and evaluating it at the horizon r equals r plus. Well, we know one thing about r plus. This is the horizon radius. It has to be the zero of this, which means that we know that R0 squared over R plus squared is equal to 1 plus R plus squared over L squared, just from setting F equal to 0. And so if you plug this in here, this simplifies the formula for the temperature, and you can write it as L squared plus 2R plus squared over 2R pi R plus L squared. So this has the following,
if you just rescale F by any factor, right? The horizon is still the same as the temperature is there. Some other condition.
You rescale F by a factor?
It's 6 by the 1, okay.
Why are you, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, so this has the following nice feature. Well, the feature first pointed out by Hawking and Page, 1984 or so, that when the black hole is small compared to the ADS radius, this term is negligible, and you get the usual answer. The L squareds cancel out, and the temperature goes like 1 over 2 pi times the Schwarzschild radius. Small black holes are very hot. That's just like the Schwarzschild answer. But when the Schwarzschild radius gets large compared to the cosmological constant, this term is negligible, and this now has a temperature which grows, like R plus. And in other words, big black holes are also hot. So for R plus much bigger than L, the temperature of the black hole is equal to R plus over pi L squared. And that's the regime we're going to be interested in.
So that has positive heat capacity.
These have positive heat capacity.
Both of them? Just this
no, one? No. The ordinary small black holes are going to be behaving just like ordinary Schwarzschild black holes.
So one calculation is of the entropy of an unstable black hole.
Well, we don't calculate the entropy of the unstable black hole. I'm going to do it for the large black hole. In fact, it's not known how to describe small Schwarzschild black holes in terms of the gauge theory, for precisely the reason you're saying. We know in some sense they're thermodynamically unstable.
Right.
The sort of stable solution is just the gas. You know, it's already evaporated. So it's because you have this other regime that, you know, things are simple.
I'm just checking my understanding.
You're right on it. Okay. Okay, so this is the regime we want to look at. This is the temperature of the black hole. Of course, we want to compute the entropy. So the entropy is just the area divided by 4, as usual. And so we now get entropy of the black hole is area over 4 times Newton's constant in 5 dimensions. And of course, this is now a 3-sphere. So the area of a 3-sphere is 2 pi squared r plus cubed over 4 g pi, or just cancel the 2s. Okay. That's the black hole entropy. Now, okay, so far this is all straight general relativity, pretty much. Same stuff we do in 4 dimensions all the time. I now need to introduce one fact from string theory. I told you I was going to need one fact from string theory, which is the relation between Newton's constant and the fundamental string parameters. Okay, so let me give it to you in 10 dimensions, which is sort of the fundamental relation, and then we'll deduce what we need. So the input from string theory is that the 10-dimensional Newton constant is equal to 8 pi to the 6th g squared. You probably heard that it's proportional to g squared. When the string coupling goes to 0, Newton's constant goes to 0. But the actual relation is 8 pi to the 6th. And don't ask me where this comes from. It'll take too long to go through it. But in some okay, so this is the input we need from string theory.
No length scale?
Sorry. Yeah. There's a string length here. String length to the 8. It's the dimensions you need for Thank you. Okay. So, what do we need? Well, we need the 5-dimensional Newton's constant.
Wait, can I stop you for one?
Sure.
Is this Then why don't we have to worry about what scale we're defining the coupling at? I mean, this is another one of these non-renormalization things.
No, the dilatone is constant for these solutions. These are Schwarzschild ADS is a solution. Well, ADS cross S5 is a solution of string theory with constant dilatone. The dilatone doesn't change with R. And you can add a Schwarzschild black hole without turning on the dilatone. So we don't need to worry about
the low energy Newton constant in 10 dimensions.
Yeah.
But what about little g as far as the string theory goes? Is that a theory which is well defined by giving its coupling constant in the infrared? I just don't know. I'm not questioning you. I just want to understand.
Well, I would say that if you want to do string theory in this, I mean, typically you would use the asymptotic value of the dilatone to define the string coupling. But if the dilatone is constant, you can use the...
You're worried about loop effects.
Worried about loop effects. Is that what you're worried about?
Yeah, I mean, like we can get this relation at the level of, right, tree-level perturbation theory. But what are we relating at the fundamental level between the two theories?
Well, in a sense, yeah. I mean, you can take the view that what you're really doing, g is always much less than 1. So in some sense, string, you want to consider a classical black hole. Okay. What we're doing basically is wanting to reproduce the entropy of a sort of classical or semi-classical black hole. So g is going to be very small, but the mass will be very big. So the product of Newton's constant times the mass will stay finite, and you'll talk about a sort of finite Schwarzschild radius. Okay. Okay, so this is our input. So now we want to compute G5. Well, G5 is just G10, and if you imagine doing a Kluze-Klein reduction, you have 1 over Newton's constant in front, but you pick up a volume of the internal space. So it's G10 over the volume of your compact space. This is G10, which is 8 pi to the 6th, G squared L the 8th. Over what's the volume of the internal space? Well, we have a 5-sphere of radius, the ADS radius. The volume of a unit 5-sphere is pi cubed, a useful fact in this business. So a unit 5-sphere has volume pi cubed. You pick up a factor of L to the 5th. And this, of course, L to the 5th. And now, we want to just rewrite this entropy in terms of these things. So the S black hole, let me just do it. So you had pi squared r plus cubed. Yeah. And 2. So it's 2g10 over the times the volume of the 5-sphere, which is pi cubed L to the 5th. And so this turns out to be pi v L to the 11th. T cubed over 2g10. I've done it in a slightly different order. All I'm doing is taking the entropy of the black hole, rewriting it in terms of string units. For this step, what I did is to use that relation between the temperature of the black hole and the horizon radius. Okay, so this is by the definition of the temperature. And now, sort of the trick is to, this is L to the 11th, okay, because you had an L to the 5th here, and you get 3 more powers of the L squared from there. And now the trick is to separate this L to the 11th, which looks pretty horrendous, into an L cubed and an L to the 8th. Remember that L... Well, you wanted to see it. L to the 8th, remember this was the ADS radius squared, and it's given by 4 pi gn squared times the string length to the 8th. Okay. So you plug that in, you can see what's going to happen. I'll just leave a couple lines of algebra here for you to check. the g squared from Newton's constant is going to cancel the g squared from the L to the A. You're going to get left with an n squared in the numerator here. And so the net result is the S black hole ends up being pi squared over 2 n squared t cubed times. I left L cubed here because that's the volume of a sphere of radius L. And so we get V3, where this is the volume of S3 with radius. Sorry. This is the volume of, it's the volume of S3 of radius L. Okay, so far, all I've done is to take the black hole solution, look at a talking Bekenstein entropy, the area over 4 Newton's constant, just rewrite that in string units, using this definition of what Newton's constant is, using that definition of what the temperature is, and you see it immediately looks like a gas in 3 plus 1 dimensions, the entropy goes like T cubed times the volume, there seems to be n squared degrees of freedom, that's all looking pretty good, but we want to check this numerical factor. And so for that, I just need to, this is an even easier calculation. So for the super Yang-Mills, now at weak coupling, we have how many fields? Well, there's one gauge field, which has 2 components, 6 scalars. That's 8 bosons, but we have an SUN theory, so there's n squared bosons, 8n squared fermions. You can look up in any standard statistical mechanical book the entropy for a single boson, the entropy is something like 2 over 45 pi squared t cubed times the volume. Fermions in 4 dimensions contribute 7/8 of the entropy as a boson, just some statistics. And so the entropy total is that's 8n squared times 1 plus 7/8 times this entropy for a single boson. And you notice this is conveniently 15 over 8, which when you multiply by 8 gives you a factor of 15, which gets rid of that 45 and gives you a 3. And so you end up with 2/3, if I did this right, 2/3 pi squared n squared n squared t cubed times the volume. Okay, and that's the statistical entropy of this gauge theory at weak coupling. So indeed, as promised, what you find is that the thing scales very similarly, but the overall numerical factor is off, and the S black hole is equal to 3/4 of the statistical.
Why don't the scalars contribute?
They do. They do. The eight bosons are 6 scalars and the 1 gauge field, which contributes 2.
So this formula principle is true only for weakly coupled bosons and weakly coupled fermions. Right?
This formula. Yeah. So now what happens? Well, you can see naively that as you turn up the coupling, you're going to add interactions. The interactions in the Yang-Mills theory are through a potential. The potential is roughly a quartic potential because you have the commutator of A squared or the commutator of the phi squared. So there's terms which look like this and some sort of effective potential, and they're positive. So as you increase the coupling, these terms start contributing to the energy. Okay, so what it means is that a given state will have its energy increased as you increase the coupling, which means that the total number of states under a given energy goes down. Well, that's just what this says. This says that at strong coupling, the total number of states per given energy is less than what it was at weak coupling. So intuitively, this is at least scaling in the right way, but the Yang-Mills interactions are incredibly complicated, and why they should, at the end of the day, give you a nice simple factor of 3/4 is a mystery.
But could one not do it by, testing harmonic oscillators with a really decoupling and then see that you really get 3/4 and not 0.001.
And it's leaving out all the tailings.
Well,
that's not going to happen.
So whatever.
And then you get it wrong again. But by a factor much faster than that.
Right, that's what I was worried about. And also, I mean, the only place where you really use this assumption that the radius is much bigger than that was when you substituted for the temperature, I think.
Right, that's right.
So the whole calculation is exactly the same if I had not done it, if I had not made this assumption.
Right. Right.
But then I seem to get manifestly wrong answers. I mean, if the opposite limit.
Well, what you find is that the entropy of a Schwarzschild black hole is not reproduced by a thermal gas in the gauge theory of the same energy. But that's not a contradiction, because the thermal gas in the gauge theory of that energy is a stable configuration, and it's describing, in the supergravity side, not a black hole, but what you get after the black hole evaporates, namely a thermal gas.
Okay, let me put that in. So, is there any hope of getting that at all? I mean, you just now argued, right, that you don't expect it from thermal gas.
Right.
So where do we expect it from?
Well, this is obviously a very special set of states in the gauge theory. Small Schwarzschild black holes are not typical generic gauge theory states. They're very special states. And so what we need to do is to find out what it is about what characterizes Schwarzschild black holes in the gauge theory. Mm-hmm. And then we have to count the number of states which have that particular property. Mm-hmm. And then we might hope to see it. Yeah?
I would object that you can work in the microcanonical ensemble with fixed energy.
Yeah.
And then up to the subtlety, you actually need a 10-dimensional and not a 5-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. There is an energy range in which the typical state is a small black hole.
That's right, it completely changes the ability.
Okay, so you're saying if you work in a microcanonical ensemble, the dominant configuration is a.
But he's going to say that on the Daniels side, it's not clear that is really being produced by a microcanonical.
Well, I should be able to work in a microcanonical ensemble on the Daniels side if the conjecture is true.
Well, but Tommy, why is the dominant configuration a small black hole?
I mean, you can have them, and they can
be. I'm confused. I'm lost.
Yeah, it's only true if you put it in a small enough box.
Well, the ADS does effectively put it in a small enough box.
Not for small. No. No, not for small black holes.
In microcanonical ensemble.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be like a sports show.
But the thing is that we don't have to look at this just to extreme limits. Presumably there is a whole range.
Yeah.
I mean, in which there is a. Right now we just read it to the drastic limit, right? I mean, which R plus is.
Well, R plus is much bigger than L.
Yeah. But presumably there is actually a range in which specific is positive.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have to really take the complete limit. I can, for example, I can just plot it, right? And then I can do the calculation for that. And again, I'm assuming that I won't get the right answer.
Well, you'll get the right answer up to the numerical factors. Because it'll be positive for R plus bigger than or border L. And when R plus is a border L, then this will still work, but maybe the numerical factor will be off. And then it's when R plus gets much less than L that things really scale differently.
Before you deflect it from Avada's question, I mean, can we push that a little bit more? So if it really is stable for some R that's just 5L or something, then there should be some rationale in the superangulus theory for the differing factors that you get, three factors. In the general sort of, to the extent that you have hand-waving understandings of the three force, do they extend to give you some understanding of the scaling with that factual, the finite size of radius, the ratio R plus L?
It sounds like a good question, but I don't know the answer. I mean, it wouldn't be hard to work out, clearly. You could work out what black holes are. Is it positive specific heat? You just look at what the formula is. And then one could see, well, does this 3/4 increase or decrease, when you go near that thing?
It'd
be nice if it goes to 1, right at the marginally stable wire. I don't know. Has anyone looked at that? It's a trivial thing to do. I don't remember looking at it. That's a good question. Yeah?
Is there any kind of independent theory check on, is there any kind of model where the entropy first rung coupled field theory does have a scaling like that?
I mean, that makes that a plausible.
A scaling where it goes from 1 to 3/4 as you increase the.
Just where the entropy in the strongly coupled field theory is qualitatively like.
It's getting false from the false.
Right. Why didn't the strong interactions kill off?
The n squared is.
Why didn't it kill off? If you look at that potential, you'd say it killed off all of the plot directions. And so why would you say it was over n?
Because you're at high energy. This is very high temperature. So you are exciting all the n squared sort of degrees of freedom.
But his question then is there an example of a known and understood field theory where the weak coupling scaling of the entropy, namely n squared in this case, would be exactly the same as the strong coupling scaling of the entropy?
That's a very good question. Presumably you can take a soluble field theory like Stein-Gordon or something, and which has a fermion and a boson.
What about Slimer-Witten duals?
Right. I mean, can't you just take a soluble field theory and calculate the entropy?
Well, it would be one plus one dimension, and that dimension takes work.
Yeah. Well, I don't know offhand of a real soluble theory where this has been checked. But again, something we could look at.
Well, why not put something in the box calculation?
Well, okay, okay, so thank you. That's a very good point. I don't want to leave you with the fact that all the string calculations get the sort of right scaling, but numerical factors are agreeing only up to factors of order unity. There certainly is a class of entropy calculations, these five-dimensional extreme and near-extreme black holes, four-dimensional extreme and near-extreme black holes, starting with the Strum and Dravatha calculation, in which the numerical factor comes out exactly right. And for the extreme black holes, we understand that should result from supersymmetry. And so we're not surprised that could be taken as an example of a field theory where the entropy does scale the same way because you're looking at supersymmetric states.
If it's extreme, you don't have to have anything to keep it at zero temperature. And here the temperature is not zero.
Right.
And so there can be, those two black holes are really not the same because one of them may require, it's sort of like your explanation, one of them requires the excitations around to keep it at a certain temperature, and the other one doesn't.
Right.
There are lots of examples of this.
So in those four and five dimensional black hole calculations, the near extremal black holes also worked, and the entropy agreed exactly.
So what does near mean? You didn't have to excite anything to keep it stable at T equal epsilon greater than zero?
No, they have positive specific heat because they're near extremal black holes.
Yeah, but if they have positive specific heat, and they have a temperature not zero, then they must be surrounded by something to keep detail balancing correct.
Okay.
And so why is it, I mean, that's left out of that calculation if T is equal to epsilon.
I mean, the entropy of the surrounding gas?
Yeah, there has to be.
But again, it's sort of some sort of classical limit. That's going to be very small compared to the entropy of the black hole itself. So it's okay
with that. But here, I mean, I'm not shocked. I can't see the picture here yet. I mean, I haven't studied this problem, but
so here it's not an infinite. The reason that could possibly be large is because space is infinite. But in ADS, the redshift makes that back that it's surrounded by effectively finite size.
Yeah, I know that.
So,
well, that's not so actually. So I mean, really is that true in every ADS? Or just in the ones you know. I mean, the Hawking page thing says that the ADS makes up its own box.
No, it's true in all dimensions.
Yeah, but that's really the lowest order. If you go to the next, just take in account the actual non-test nature of the photons in the box, the ADS box, you will find that the Hawking page conjecture is wrong. The back reaction.
For the back reaction.
Yeah, the back reaction. And it has to be wrong because it has to be detailed balancing at the edge of this ADS box. And so there must be photons coming in. And if there are photons coming in, then you're going to get, you get a logarithmic infinity. I've done this. So is Bernard Whiting, so is Bruce.
Again, we should talk about that. I mean,
yeah.
I would have thought that things were very...
No, everybody thinks that, but they haven't done the back reaction calculation.
Okay.
And it doesn't work.
Wait, the photons bounce off the boundary. Why?
No.
Classically, they reach the boundary by quantum mechanics.
No, not photons.
Yes, photons.
They bounce off the boundary.
Yeah.
So we put reflecting boundary.
Depends on what boundary conditions you
use. No, that's not right.
It's another question mark.
I missed the evidence that the full string theory is given by the gauge.
So I don't know if you like this or not, but there was an argument that the Jacobs are coming off the Firepop gave, which was just that there are other states, there are other fields in the Yang-Mills theory, which are not part of the special class of operators, and those operators, those composite operators, will have dimensions which are not protected, and so they have very large dimensions, it turns out, in the strong coupling regime, and people believe that those are describing excited states of the string.
Is it a tenable proposition that the Yang-Mills theory gives some other quantum completion of 2D supergravity other than 2D string theory? Is that a tenable proposal or not?
So tenable, you mean is there actual concrete evidence against it?
Concrete evidence against it other than that you don't like it.
Strong evidence.
Most of the loops in the gauge theory make states that look like strings.
But there again, there's no field theory verification of the scaling of the coefficient.
Yeah. Here's an argument.
The would be to verify the prediction of the dimension, or to verify the prediction of the coefficient.
Here, let's turn it around. Maybe this is what you just said. Flux tubes. So strings in ABS, right, are described by flux tubes in the gauge theory. You obviously have these flux tubes. You can think of them as Wilson loops acting on the vacuum. These flux tubes describe strings.
There aren't any flux tubes in a non-confining theory in the sense that you think of them in a confining theory. So, I mean, I can write down a Wilson loop operator, but what is the evidence that that operator creates a 2B string in the ball?
The strings ending on a D ring precisely do carry the fundamental charge of the gauge group.
Or just Higgs mechanisms, right? Breaking the gauge symmetry, we interpret as sort of splitting off one of the three brains and having a three brain in the bulk. So you can obviously break the gauge symmetry that way, right? So you have to have three brains in your ADS.
And the W bosons have the right mass to be a stretched string.
And the W bosons have the right mass. Yeah, there are certainly aspects which work. Now, I'm not saying they won't work in some other theory. which you might hope to construct. But there are checks which involve sort of these stretched strings.
These things go back to the D-brain picture. So I need to go back to that picture in order to see these things.
Well, these arguments we've just been making indeed sort of use some of the other things we know about D brains in string theory.
Just going back to the thing, I mean, you were starting about telling us about this Stromberg wildfire relationship, right?
So what's the difference?
So I could do the same calculation in this framework, right? I mean, I could consider the extremal black hole, just put the charge in.
Okay, so the main difference is that here we've talked about only one charge. I mean, well, the charge is gone because we're in this near horizon window.
No, but I could just do the same calculation. So that five-dimensional, just take the extremal black hole with the parameter of the Stromberg wildfire gas.
Right.
And I could just, as you said, it's such a nice calculation. It's all on the board.
Yeah.
So I could just do it for that five-dimensional.
You can do it. And what you will find is the entropy now scales like a 1+1 dimensional field theory. Okay.
You mean just coming from the
black hole side. You take the five-dimensional black hole. You compute the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, you re-express it in string units, and you see something which, again, is sort of growing like n squared, although it's more like Q1, Q5, where it's the number of one brains and five brains, but it has a factor of sort of the temperature, just T, I guess. It's for a 1+1 dimensional field theory. Okay, so now the question is, what is the string description of that? And so you go through, now going back to the D-brain description, of the sort of one brains and the five brains, and you have these.
So I want the same kind of Yang-Mills thing.
Well, but the point is the Yang-Mills theory is much more complicated. It is, what is it? You start with a sort of a SU.
Yeah.
So the problem is that you start with something which is like an SU Q5 gauge theory on the five brain, and you have an SU sort of Q1 gauge theory on the one brains.
There's supposed to be just one Yang-Mills key, right?
No, see the extreme black holes are obtained by, first of all, by the following construction. You need a certain number of 5 brains. You bring all that together. And now you add to it a certain number of 1 brains. And then you put the 1 brains on top of the 5 brains. And now you ask, what are the low energy excitations of that whole
system? But what does that state in the Yang-Mills theory?
There's supposed to be some description of Yang-Mills theory.
How do you describe a brain in the Yang-Mills theory?
I don't know.
This is not contained in Wan's conjecture. Okay, we've now changed our boundary conditions.
This is not contained in Wan's conjecture in the ADS-5.
In the ADS-5 case, right. Okay, so if you take the near horizon limit of this black hole, you get an ADS-3. So what we should be asking for is, in the ADS-3 cross S-3 example, what is all of this? And then, yes, then the theory on the boundary is a 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory, which is, well, it's not an ordinary Yang-Mills theory in 1 plus 1 dimensions. It's a little bit more complicated, because that has a dimensionful coupling constant. And so you have to construct that theory by sort of going back to...
So what goes wrong? I got a five-dimensional black hole, right, in that case. It's right. An extremely five-dimensional black hole.
Right.
But there's no cosmological constant. It's not quantum.
That's right. Okay, so the asymptotically flat solution, no cosmological constant.
So the statement is that their calculation, I could not have repeated if there was a cosmological constant.
No. The point is that you never put in by hand a cosmological constant. You take your five-dimensional black hole, and you just look at the near-horizon geometry. Just like Reiser-Nordström, there's no cosmological constant there. The near-horizon geometry is ADS2 cross S2. So the charge effectively gives you the cosmological constant, which is canceled between the positive and negative curvatures. In five-dimensional black holes, it's exactly the same, except that you get, it's better to think of it as a six-dimensional black string, and then you get an ADS3 cross S3, is the sort of near-horizon geometry of that six-dimensional solution.
So there is no calculation which gives you the exact result in the. If I had a five-dimensional black hole with a cosmological constant,
with cosmological constant.
Yeah. Is there a calculation?
You mean like this?
Not like this, but the one which gives you the correct numerical answer. I'm trying to compare two things, and right. Basically, I understood from you that there are.
Okay. I think the answer is yes. That if you want a five-dimensional black hole, which asymptotically is anti-de Sitter in 5 dimensions, I don't know of a calculation which gets the numerical factor right. So in fact, essentially all, maybe all, calculations in which you get the numerical factor and the entropy right reduce in the near-horizon limit to ADS3. So I think essentially, maybe all the calculations in which the entropy comes out exactly right have a near-horizon limit, which is ADS3. And then one has arguments, well, Steve Carlett and Andy, and people have talked about special properties of ADS3, which allow you to count the entropy.
The most important special properties of the dual field theory is 1 plus 1 dimensional, and you have a much larger symmetry.
But what, here we're invoking something happens with strong coupling and so on. So what I do, I mean, is it a surprise? I mean, is it a wrong result that you get the right answer?
You're saying, is there an argument? Well, if you're down in ADS3, yes, Sunny?
The thing is that in ADS3, you actually can take the extreme limit. But here, if you take the extreme limit, the temperature is zero, and you're then in the unfortunate circumstance that you have zero entropy on one side, and it's a little difficult to compare to something, and the black hole is simpler, and really good.
No, but there, ADS3, just the near horizon geometry is ADS3, it's not that the whole space time geometry is ADS3.
Oh, sure.
Right.
But at least you have a regular near horizon geometry, which is regularly in the extreme limit. That means you can actually use a VPS argument, and therefore you trust that a weak and strong coupling ought to give the same, and you're then not surprised that it gives the same. Mm-hmm. Once you then, in that case, go slightly non-extreme, you would still get the right result, and there you can perhaps say that you ought to be a little bit surprised that it still works.
Well, except...
That it still works, and you can perhaps argue that it should, but it's certainly a harder argument than in the extreme limit.
It still works, and it is a little bit of a surprise, but you can do the following thing. You can take the near-extremal black hole, so you've moved a little bit away from extremality. You go near the horizon, and you find exactly ADS3 again. So the ADS3 is not perturbed.
Even as you move a little bit away from...
One of the problems that several of us coming from classical that actually have is understanding what it means to say it looks like it is. And I wish there was some precise statement. Because obviously it's different, right? I mean, at some level it is different. Because it's not true that the... the extreme and the non-extreme are indistinguishable. I mean, some are indistinguishable. So
it's locally in ES3, I guess. The identification is different. That's what.
Right, but sort of locally to what order they characterize it in a variant way of looking.
Well, what that means is that the curvature is the same as the curvature of ADS3.
Evaluated on the submanifold of the horizon.
Well, basically, you take some neighborhood of the horizon. If I'm close enough to extremality, there's an arbitrarily large amount of space there. So I throw away the asymptotic region.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. As small a neighborhood as you want of the horizon. But finite.
It's exactly the same curvature. It's a three-dimensional manifold. The only curvature I have is Ricci curvature, and I haven't put any matter in, so it must be.
It's a hard problem. You can't say that the curvatures are the same. It's the same geometry. That's well known to be incredibly difficult to prove. Look, I'd like to clarify from a very simple-minded, stupid point of view that my discussion with Ted, I mean, the ordinary 3+1 dimensional ADS black hole, if you consider test particles, they bounce off, photons bounce off, okay? So the conjecture was this is a natural box. Fine, like a finite box, and we don't have to do anything stupid like Jimmy York does, which is to actually draw a box. But if you calculate the stress tensor for that equilibrium state, the lowest non-trivial order, and put that correction in, you do not get finite results. You get logarithmic infinities in the energy and the entropy, and that's an endon. So if you're really wanting this ADS stuff to be fundamentals, you have to realize that it's not true that the ADS black hole, at least in 3+1 dimensions, acts like a box.
Are you
it
sure
doesn't.
You've done that calculation in an ADS background and find logarithms?
Jensen and Whiting did it first, and then I did it again.
Well, that's pretty interesting, doesn't it seem?
You damn right it's pretty interesting. It's interesting, right?
Okay.
It might even be fundamental.
Well, it certainly seems worth pursuing because that would correspond to a quantum correction to this, which should be described. I mean, the gauge theory is describing all of string theory. It's certainly describing these quantum corrections.
Yes.
But if you're changing fundamentally your asymptotic boundary conditions, then either the Green's function needs to be modified so that the boundary conditions are preserved by hand because you sort of put that into the problem, or one has to sort of rethink this a little bit.
Yeah, no, it does need, to me, in my view, it needs a little rethinking. Since it's playing a rather important role here.
Okay.
And I know this is the right answer.
Okay, say Simeon.
For the quantum correction.
I have another question. The quantization of the five-form flux, isn't that in string theory effect or the supergravity effect?
Thank you, Gary. That's
The actual quantization condition, I think, comes from string theory, from the free brains and stuff. So otherwise, you just have this form and you can sort of scale it as you want.
Yeah. So then, isn't that pretty good evidence that there can be, you know, this isn't talking about another non-perturbative convention?
Too bad Mark has already left. Well, I don't know. I mean, you could, if you're going to imagine that this gauge theory is dual to some other completion of supergravity, then maybe it could have the same quantization condition. I mean, it could be interpreted in some completely different way where it doesn't matter. But hard to argue against it.
It's also too bad that Mark left, because he made a comment which was what experts have said, and several of us didn't understand in the beginning.
What's that?
About something about, we don't know how to do something with the amount of our fields. What was that something?
Okay. When string theory first got going in the mid-80s, a lot of effort was devoted to developing the perturbation expansion. So the story was is that we picked some classical solution, some equation, and we talked about strings propagating in the background, and we talked about perturbative scattering. But these backgrounds were usually characterized by the metric, this B mu nu, anti-symmetric tensor fields, and a dilaton, and did not have any of these Ramon fields turned on. Okay, it was just, I don't know why, it was just while we had our hands full of just understanding this, and it didn't seem like it was that important to worry about the Ramon fields. Okay, now with D-brains and everything else, we realize that these Ramon-Ramon fields are very important. The way the string couples to the Ramon-Ramon fields is more complicated than the way it couples through this. Think of the fermions coming in some complicated way. So you cannot sort of, in this case, you can more or less go to this nice conformal gauge, and you know, you could use some tricks and quantize the string. In the case when the Ramon-Ramon background is turned on, it's technically much more complicated to study the usual string scattering and stuff. So that's what he was referring to.
So you're just saying that, well, we don't know, I mean, in the conjecture, when that we don't know how to do the string theory with the rules of the Ramon-Ramon.
That's what he meant. Yeah.
Any other questions? So if we take the temperature and gradually start raising it in the boundary, we should reach some critical value at which the black hole would appear in the corresponding bulk.
Right.
Is that a phase transition that you should be able to recognize in the boundary and expect or not expect? And
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was just a talk yesterday by Clifford Johnson on this.
Yeah. He was throwing in another...
another primitive charge.
So just in the simple context that you're talking about right here.
Right. In fact, you can see why there's a phase transition in the following simple way. I've already given you all the information you need. At low energies, suppose you just sort of excite the gauge theory a little bit. What are the states going to be? Well, they're going to be in one-to-one correspondence with these supergravity states. So in particular, the states are all sort of gauge invariant, you know, made up from these, you know, trace of some product of operators. And how many states are there for a given energy? Well, it's going to scale like an ordinary supergravity gas. Okay, actually in 10 dimensions because these things. So that the entropy, I don't know, so the energy will go like some temperature to the, 10th power, and the entropy will go like a temperature to the 9th power. Because in the super Yang-Mills theory, this is how things will scale at low temperatures, at low energies, because you're exciting just the supergravity modes. There's no n squareds here, because you don't have n squared different supergravity fields.
How would you have extra factors of the temperature going to come in?
Well, it's because of the number of fields, right? It's the number of states.
But that should multiply the... Oh, because of the tower of states.
It's the tower of states which come in on that whole thing. So this is the way it works out, that you get this behavior. Now, at high temperature, then, of course, you're just sort of exciting all the n-squared fields, and you have an entropy which grows like n-squared. So in a large n limit, you do see a very dramatic difference between the behavior of the theory at low temperature, where the sort of things are of order 1, independent of n, and at high temperature when things scale like n squared.
Uh-huh.
And that's associated with the sort of black hole dominating the partition function in the gravity side.
Can you estimate the temperature at which you think that should happen independently of the black hole picture?
Well, for a gauge theory on the sphere, the only scale you have is the radius of the sphere. And so when the temperature is of order, right, this is a conformal field theory. And you're putting it on a sphere of radius, the ADS radius.
Yeah, but surely that radius is not relevant to the phase transition.
Well, it is, because it's precisely, I mean, it's when your temperature is big compared to 1 over that radius, that you go to this other phase.
So it's actually a very low temperature if I were a Yang-Millesian kind of creature.
Right.
I would think of that as very low.
Yeah.
When you gave us the evidence, you told us, well, there's huge number of supergravity fields, and there really are huge number of Yang-Millesians also because they're composite objects.
Right.
And then you also told these questions, well, there's a whole Fock space of states, and they're all like particles and everything. So when it comes to counting here, why did we just count n bosons and n fermions, and why don't those act as independent?
Well, this does though, that for you. So this is the formula. This is for one boson. So what do I mean? I mean that you take, you know, you have one fundamental scalar field, but you consider the whole Fock space of states, you know, many, many particle states. This is just the usual gas.
No, I think previously I thought your point of view was that this states of the composite objects, were they also elements of the Fock field, the fundamental object, or they were most things.
So the statement is that at low energies, the only states of the gauge theory on the sphere, at strong coupling, the correspondence is at strong coupling. So you want to go to low energy, but large coupling, then the claim is that you only see the states created by those composite operators, and you don't see the usual, the n squared other states, because they've sort of got pushed off to higher energy.
That's our conceptual thing. Just on the Yang-Hills side up here.
Yeah.
Am I thinking of, when you talk about these bosons and fermions, in some sense you're already in weak coupling, right? Because otherwise it doesn't really make sense to
This calculation was weak coupling, right? This is weak coupling.
Somebody gives me the super Yang-Hills theory, and I want to know what is the hyperspace of states for that theory at any coupling. And then you can say that, these are excited at some coupling, and these are not, or these are relevant at some coupling, and these are not relevant at coupling.
Mm-hmm.
And is that hyperspace of states consists of just the fundamental fields, and they say that, for the purpose of discussion, clock space based on them? Or does it contain, in addition to that, clock spaces associated with composite fields?
Okay, now I see the question. What's the answer?
We can call it a Lutetian thing. The exact clock space which would just be calculated by the annihilation integration product of the 8 n squared bosons and 8 n squared fermions.
So the composite operators create states which are just composites of these.
Yeah. So you are just recounting known.
Is that right? So that was very good, clear. So the statement that composite objects are not separate Hilbert spaces.
No, the point is, I think that Gary was trying to make is that as a quantum coupling regime, you cannot do. You don't have the world defined. You don't know what is your fox space.
So maybe Abe, the way to think about this is like bound states. So at weak coupling, all your states are just these, the sort of naive ones. But now you increase the coupling, and many of these states become very massive, become very energetic. But certain combinations of them, basically form bound states and stay light. And so at strong coupling, when you're counting states, you're counting just those light states, which are somehow, the composites of these.
And so even though you have these huge towers of bound states, that doesn't matter because they get massive.
You mean other composite operators that I had that were
right.
Orange?
I mean, you can write down
there's
as many composite operators as you want,
uh-huh.
Right?
Did you have a seminar?
Yeah,
I think we need to get out. Okay, thank you.